You're listening to the Old Time Radio Show on 71K News Talk Radio. Now back to Denver's Old Time Radio History buff, John Dunning.
And I think, I'm not sure of this, I think there was a money thing involved or something. The feeling I got was that people other than Phil and Frankie sat down and started arguing about whether Phil should be paying Remley for the use of his name, although I was doing it. I don't think Remley was a part of it, and I don't think Phil was a part of it. But the result of it was that Phil got mad and said, to hell with it, we'll call you by your right name. Which seemed wrong. It wasn't as funny. Elliot's not funny. Frankie's funny.
It didn't really affect the performance of the show, though. I mean, the writing still...
No, we did the same thing, didn't
sure.
make it different. But it's... For Phil to say Elliot is not as funny as for Phil to say Frankie, you know? I don't know why, but...
You know, Fred Allen has something in one of his books about words that are funny and names that are funny. And, you know, there's some truth in that. So there are some names and some words that just are inherently funnier than others.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, the example of my name is not funny. Remley is funny. Elliot Lewis doesn't sound very funny. Mm. But you get a picture when you say Frankie Remley. Whether or not you had ever heard him. I think the reason that Jack Benny used the name so much is because it sounded funny.
Yeah.
You know, when he said Remley. He was the nicest man.
Jack Benny?
Oh, yeah, and Remley, too. I mean.
Yeah.
You know, Remley was left-handed, and I'm left-handed. And Remley played guitar left-hand. In other words, he strung it upside down. So that one of the jokes we wanted to do one week worked out pretty good because they wanted me to walk out on the stage with the guitar, and they were doing, this may have been the first one I did, it was the story of how Phil met Remley. And so what happened was that there's this bum on a street in New Orleans or somewhere playing his guitar and singing "You Are My Sunshine." And the joke is when you hear the coin drop in the tin cup, and Remley stops singing and says, "Thank you, sir." So I had to learn how to play three chords on the guitar, and Remley taught me how to do it. And fortunately, I could use his spare guitar because we were both left-handed. But he had it was a six-string guitar. I remember he had to take two strings off because I couldn't even handle it with four. You know, with six, it was impossible. I didn't seem to have enough fingers to go around. But it got such a yell.
You know, just hearing that is an enriching kind of thing, to know that Remley had that much of a hand in it, and the actual Remley did.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Do you still see Phil Harris?
I haven't seen Phil in... I don't know, I'm very bad on time. I could say, it seems to me when I see somebody that I just saw them 3 or 4 days ago, and it turns out it was 15 years. So I really don't know. It seems to me I saw Phil 4 or 5 years ago, and I talked to Alice on the phone a couple of 2, 3 years ago about something. I think I had we had a script on a Mutual Radio Theater I thought she might want to do, and she was interested in it, but she was going out on the road with a show, and she wasn't available. But the last time I saw Phil, whenever it was, some years, we had breakfast together and kind of chatted, and he had an idea of something he wanted to do that sounded just marvelous, which would have involved all of us making our living by sailing around the world for nothing on a luxury liner. I don't know where he cut that.
That is a pretty nice way to live.
Well, he thinks of things like that. First cabin has always been Phil's idea of the way to go, and I agree with him.
He, of course, learned an awful lot about comedy from Jack Benny, didn't he?
Oh, yes. Jack was the best teacher in the world. I remember I was still in school the first time I worked for Jack, because the Benny show was for Young and Rubicam had the account. And we broadcast from what is now KHJ Mutual on Melrose Avenue right next to the Paramount Studios. At that time, that was where the NBC shows came from. NBC had not yet built the big building now torn down at the corner of Sunset and Vine. And I got a job on a Benny show. I had three or four lines. I think the sketch was, yes, it was, the sketch was that Benny was moving, right, from that studio up to the new studio. And in the script were two moving men named Mervyn and Laverne. And I was to be one of the moving men, a big dummy kind of a guy. And Bill Morrow, the writer of the show, played the other moving man. And it really went very, very well. I was very pleased and, of course, honored to be there. And Jack was very, very sweet to me, and he wrote me a note. And he sent me an extra check. And he said, you got a laugh. I don't remember what the line was. And I didn't think that you would. And so this is because you did such a nice job. Thank you, and we'll see you soon. And from that day on, I did three or four Benny shows every year. At the Christmas shopping thing, I was a character, the same big jerk that Jack called the Mully. And I don't know what it meant or how it was spelled, or but anyway, that was his name. He would say, you do the Mully this week. And then we would do the, one of the other appearances would be the song thing. The first one of those, remember when they would all go down to the railroad station, Mel Blanc would call the train,
sure. Yeah.
Cucamonga,
right.
That thing. They would always work into that, the people lined up waiting to get their tickets, and of course something would happen to Jack. Sheldon Leonard would try to tout him onto something. And one year they worked out a thing, and I was standing in front of Jack in line, and Frank Nelson was the ticket agent. And this is a good story also about how it was to work with a man like Jack. The routine went, Jack is trying to get his ticket, and I'm in front of him. And Frank Nelson says to me, can I help you, sir? And I say, does this train go to Glockamora? And Frank says, yes. And I say, how are things at Glockamora? And he says, fine. And I say, is the little brook still rippling there? And we go on, we do the song that way. Well, just before broadcast, Jack came over to me and he said, I don't think we can do it that way. I think, I'm scared. I don't know if anybody's going to laugh. So I said, we'll do it any way you want. And he said, well, let's think about it. And then he kind of paced around and he said, no, we've gone this far and we all thought it was funny and we decided that's the way to do it and that's the way we're going to do it. And I did about four lines before anything happened, and then the audience realized what was happening and they started laughing.
Mm.
So that each year I would be on the Benny Show at about that time of the year also, and we would do those song things. I remember we did the Tennessee Waltz one year too.
You know, that is a very memorable show. And Frank Nelson, in fact, cited that as one of his most vivid memories of the Benny program.
The Glockamora?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It was hysterical.
Very.
Because by the time you get into the middle of it, it is so ridiculous. And, of course, it helps tremendously that Jack Benny is standing there holding his elbow as he did, looking impatient and disgusted. You know, and Frank, no matter what question I ask, Frank is going, fine, yes, you know. Funny routine.
But you know, it seemed that when Phil Harris started his own show, he took what Jack Benny did, and he even, if anything, even accelerated it, because it came off. Frankie Remley, to me, as I listen to those old shows, is the epitome of sarcasm on radio.
Yeah.
I mean, that is probably the most vivid example of sarcastic humor I think I've ever heard. That show.
Yes. Yeah.
And it seemed like he learned that from Benny, but a lot of it was with the writers, Ray Singer and Dick Chevalier, right?
Oh, yes. They wrote brilliant scripts. Just brilliant scripts. I remember the character was so firmly implanted that they did a whole script to get one line in. The script was Alice telling Phil that Remley was no good, that Remley was taking advantage of him, that Remley was using him, and that he should wise up and not have friends like Remley. And Phil says, I'll show you what a nice guy he is. And he tells Remley that he's progressively more ill to see if Remley will pay attention to him and take care of him and be kind and considerate and loving. And it builds until Remley comes to the door one day. Now you're in the last scene. And knocks on the door, and Alice opens the door in tears. And Remley says, hi, Alice. And she cries. And Remley says, what's the matter? And Alice says, oh, Phil, Frankie, it's terrible. Phil is dead. And there's a long pause, and Remley says, Alice, will you marry me? Boy, you know, if you want to know about friendship, you can imagine the laugh.
That's wonderful.
The worst thing. And we were sitting in the hall one day, and I said to Jack Benny, I know this is funny material, and I know Alice and Phil and I are doing it well, but the laughs are so much more explosive. They are so much bigger than I expect. What are they laughing at? And Jack said, you and Phil say and do under whatever the circumstance of the story is, all of the things that people really would like to say and do if they had the nerve. And that's the laughter. That's what you're hearing. But we would get those kind of laughs. You know, we'd put poor Tedley in the oven once.
Did you actually do that?
No.
I mean, how did you... I've always been kind of curious to wonder how an audience that sees all these things visually on stage reacts to a gag like that.
Well, they see Tedley standing there holding a script in front of his mouth so he sounds like he's inside an oven. And they see a big metal thing that the sound man is pounding on, and they go along with it. They know what the picture is. And they're not seeing what they're seeing, really. They're seeing what the story tells them that they're seeing.
Uh-huh.
And they enjoy it tremendously. We used to have, in the live radio days, you did everything in front of an audience. And those theaters were packed by people who thoroughly enjoyed sitting there and watching half a dozen actors standing in front of microphones reading off a script, you know.
Hmm.
Well, of course, it works in the theater, too, if you have a reading. I'm thinking, I suddenly got a picture in my mind of going to see Don Juan in Hell, and Lawton, and Aggie, and who else was in there? Boyer.
Hmm.
Reading off of lectern. And it was magic, you know, because the words were so powerful.
You're listening to the Old Time Radio Show on 71K News Talk Radio. Now back to Denver's Old Time Radio History buff, John Dunning.
We are back with about 23 minutes left and not nearly enough time for me to ask all the questions I want to ask. But one of the questions I particularly wanted to ask you, I'm talking to Elliot Lewis again from Los Angeles. When you play a part like Frankie Remley, I listened to some of your portrayals on Suspense, and you go from within 1 week playing a real psychopathic character to playing Frankie Remley. How do you do that? I mean, that's.
I don't know.
I'm thinking. I think of a real loser you played on a show with Judy Garland. You remember the show Drive-In?
Oh, yeah.
Where you take her out on the hills overlooking the city and try to kill her with a knife.
She falls in love with the guy, doesn't she? Isn't that the story?
I think you fall off the cliff to your death in the end.
Yeah, no, I mean, in the story, it seemed to me it was the basic plot line of that.
Well, I think the way it works is she's a car hop.
Yeah.
And you've just come from killing somebody.
I hold her hostage, don't you?
Yeah, she sees the blood in the car or something
like
that.
Yeah. Who wrote that? Do you remember?
I sure don't. I'd have to go back and listen to the credits. But
yeah.
But, you know, you don't get much farther from Frankie Rimley than a show like that.
Well, I remember a Sunday. Remember John Nesbitt's passing parade?
Oh, sure.
Well, we used to do the Benny show from that studio on Mill Road that I described from 4 to 4:30 to the east. And Nesbitt's passing parade was at CBS, which is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 and a half blocks away. From 4:30 to 5. I was on both shows one week. It never occurred to me that my car wouldn't start, that I might not have, that I might have an accident, that I, in one script, had a part where I was playing the Mully, and I was going to drive during closing commercial, system cue, and opening commercial on the Nesbitt show to CBS to walk in and play Dr. Semmelweis, the man who discovered and cured childbed fever.
Hmm.
Never occurred to me that there was a problem, that there might be a problem, that it was impossible. When you're young and stupid, you can do almost anything. You know, that something is only dangerous and foolhardy and could be difficult if you have the brains to know it. If you don't know it, you just go ahead and do it. So I suppose when I was doing Remley, I was doing Remley. You do Remley, and when I picked up the script on Suspense to work with Judy, then I'm playing that kind of a guy. You know?
I'm sure once you get the character of Remley established, and it becomes almost like a part of your I don't want to say Remley is a part of your personality, but...
No, I guess it is, though, because I'm not doing anything magical, or didn't think I was when I was doing it. I was just playing that kind of a guy who didn't particularly care, you know.
But even in those early shows, the earliest of the Phil Harris shows, if you listen back to them today, Remley is totally consistent throughout that run. I mean, there didn't seem to be a time, at least to the casual listener, when you were breaking that character in.
I don't think we ever did. I think it was one of those lucky, fortuitous accidents. I picked up the first script and played it the way I thought it would be funny, and the way it would work with Phil, without too much effort. And it worked, the people laughed, and the rest of it goes to Singer and Chevrolet for writing that thing every week, you know. They kept the character, and they keep the consistency then of the relationships and the humor and everything else.
One of the things also that I've noticed is that, listening back to the Zero Hours, you had Ann Whitfield on one of them?
Yeah.
And you used scripts by Shirley Gordon, who was one of your, I would call, major writers on stage.
Right.
You must have kept in contact with a lot of these folks from those days.
Still, not Ann. I called Ann. I haven't really seen any of those people. We see Shirley quite often. We see E-Jack. We see Mark Fine. Hi, Averback. I worked with Fletcher Markle on the last two shows. We see Fletcher and Dee Dee. So the contacts are kept. We all worked very closely together in those days. And as in any working relationship, in any business that you're in, when you've worked with people for 10 or 15 or 20 years, you spend a lot of time with them, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know what they can do.
Exactly. And you're especially comfortable working with them. The radio business, the entertainment business, the writing business, is a high-risk business. High risk in the sense that you're always working with your neck stuck out. And so as many people who are sympathetic to that as you can find is who you surround yourself with.
Boy, I can say amen to that.
You know, well, of course. You know, you're sitting there on the air, live, and you don't know what I'm going to say next, but you're hoping.
Yeah.
Right.
How did you get into directing?
Well, I had kind of, when I started on the Silver Theater show as an actor that I was talking about, the first Young and Rubicam Network show on CBS on Sunday afternoons, I got on it Glenn Hall Taylor was the producer and director, and True Boardman was the head writer on the show. And the first show starred Jimmy Stewart and Rosalind Russell. And they needed somebody who could say in tempo with a music score and a phonograph sound effects record, who could say, you better go back, you better go back, you better go back, you better go back, and do it in tempo and keep doing it. And True and Glenn Hall asked me if I could do it. They knew me from the soap opera that I was doing for the agency. And I could, so I got the job. And I went over to do the Silver Theater. Now I've rambled, so I forgot your question.
I was gonna ask you, too, if you kept in contact with Glenn Hall Taylor.
Yeah, I see Glenn Hall every once in a while over at the Pacific Pioneer Luncheons every now and then.
He was on the show.
Oh, Glenn.
We had him about 2 months ago. I asked you how you got into directing, and that was leading.
Those shows, I asked the men, because I always found acting boring, because there's not enough to do. You do it, and then you're finished, and now what are you going to do, you know? They would go back to the office to do rewrites and changes and all that kind of stuff. So I would go into the booth and listen when I wasn't on in the scene, and then I'd go back to the office and they'd let me sit there with them when they were doing rewrites and cuts. And I was just a kid. And so I got interested in all of it, and when I started working on Suspense, Spear asked me, because I was writing Suspense in addition to acting on it, I wrote some of them, and I edited a great many of them. And Spear had to go away, and he asked me if I wanted to direct it, and I said, yeah, sure. So I directed one, and then the CBS people wanted to do Broadway's My Beat, which had been on in the East. They wanted to move it out here, and they needed a producer-director. And Mort Fine and David Friedkin were going to write it, and we cooked up the idea of scoring it with a jazz orchestra and got Sandy Courage for that. And I all of a sudden was directing a show every week. And from that, I started directing. I did my own series on stage, and I directed Crime Classics, and I was directing Suspense and Pursuit, and finally wasn't acting at all anymore, except on stage and doing Remley. I didn't have time.
Hmm. Was it your idea originally to bring top-flight comedians in to do dramatic roles on Suspense?
I don't know if it was my idea. I thought it was a good idea. I didn't see any reason not to do it. I remember we had one script. I was standing in the bank one day before they have the lines they have now, where a single line spreads to all of the windows. When you went to the bank to cash a check or do your business, you selected a window and you stood in that line. And it seemed to me this one day, because I was in a hurry to get back to my office, that everybody in my line had a bag full of business to do with the bank teller, and every other line was moving quickly. And so I went back to the office, and I thought, gee, that'd be a funny thing to happen to Jack Benny. And we did a script where it does happen to him, and who wrote that? I think Henry.
I remember the show, though.
Yeah, because what he doesn't know is that the bag that he thinks contains money has a note in it saying, this is a stick-up, give me all your money.
Right.
And the crooks are driving around the block ready to pick him up, and he's standing in a line that's not moving, you know. So it was a good, funny suspense show, but it had to be done by a comic.
Hmm.
We got the script, and the sponsor called when we were in rehearsal and said, we won't let you do it because it's not a suspense show, and it's not funny, and it's just terrible. So I said, well, we have to do it because Mr. Benny's here, and he likes it. And we did it, and it was enormously successful.
Sponsors are always wrong.
Well, it's not that they're wrong as much as if I'm sponsored by, let's say, the Electric Auto Light Company, I am not going to tell them how to make spark plugs because I don't think I'm qualified. But for some reason, everybody in the world thinks that they know how to act, how to read scripts,
how to write,
how to direct, how to produce, how to play musical instruments, how to sing operas, any of those things, how to paint a picture. And they don't. And all that you would hope for is that they would have the grace to acknowledge that there are people who know how to do it and that they would have some respect for it.
Who have learned how to do it through a very, very painful learning process. It doesn't come easy.
No. How many pages a day do you do?
sometimes five.
Yeah,
but that's 7 days a week. I mean, you know, you
I know.
Well, it sounded like a flip comment when I said sponsors are always wrong, but that's what I mean. I mean, whenever a sponsor...
In that sense, because they think they know, because they are the sponsor, and therefore they think they are in control, and therefore they think they know, and they're going to tell you how to do it. And, of course, that's exactly the wrong thing to be doing. There are many television shows today that reflect that. They look like they were put together by people who have absolutely no business sticking their noses into something they don't know anything about. They wouldn't do it in anything else. You wouldn't go in when the plumber was fixing your pipes and say, step away from there, sir, and I'll do it. So why do you go in and say, no, this scene won't work? You know,
well, there was
somebody
a...
that doesn't know how to read a script is calling on the telephone to say a scene won't play. Well, that's insanity. A person like that should be locked away in an institution.
There was an anecdote on Gunsmoke where the agency band was sitting up in the booth or something, and there was a line in the script that said where Matt Dillon was supposed to have said, well, we're lucky that didn't happen, and he just went through the roof. He said, well, you can't have the word lucky on a show that's sponsored by Chesterfield.
Right.
And that's the kind of thing we're talking about, where agencies and sponsors and so forth just really should butt out and not be involved in
it. We had one like that when I was producing the Lucy show at a Christmas show. Agency man is sitting there at the dress rehearsal. End of the Christmas show, group of child singers arrive at the door to sing a carol. And Lucy opens the door and says, oh, come in, Merry Christmas, lovely closing. And they go, joy to the world. And the agency man went right through the roof, because that was a competing product. Joy.
Incredible.
You know. So it's you're dealing with what we used to call the League of Frightened Men. All the people that are afraid to have opinions or have judgments or allow anybody else to have them for fear of rocking the boat.
Boy, that's a devastating series of words. The League of Frightened Men.
Yeah, well, that's what we always used to call them. You know. I used to have a cup on my desk that I kept pencils in, and I had painted on it a famous Fred Allen line, which is, where were you when the page was blank? And I would turn the cup around when somebody came in 5 minutes before airtime with 17 pages of notes about how they would have done it, you know?
Yeah.
I think we all know editors like that.
Oh, yes. Well, I know them very well. I've got 5 minutes, and I would be totally remiss, at least to myself, if I didn't ask you about On Stage, which is one of my absolutely favorite shows, and I'm not just saying that because you're here. You did some wonderful stuff on that show, and it just seemed to come along too late, didn't it?
Well, it occurred to me years later how many shows we did and what kind of writing we had and the kind of chances that we took. And I still can't believe we did it. I suppose if I were given the opportunity, I'd do the same thing again. It seems to me that that's the kind of... If you're going to do an anthology, which that was, that's the kind of anthology to do. You do a little bit of everything. You take all kinds of chances. I remember... remember the one we did called Conrad in Quest of His Youth?
I've never heard that one.
Marvelous novel that was written, I don't know, 1907 or 1908. I'm not in the room with the books, so I can't just turn around and find it for you. Anyway, E. Jack did an adaptation of one section of it, It was a magnificent show. Fred Steiner did music for it. Just lovely, lovely love story. All the things. E-Jack wrote, I don't know, what, a dozen fantastic original stories. Shirley Gordon did such good stuff.
She did a thing called Call Me a Cab.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah. She did a lot of good stuff. Shirley's been writing children's books, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I think she's written 7 children's books.
That's a pretty good field to get into if you want to be a writer.
Yeah, it sure is. I think they're for Harper and Row. You might look around and see if you got, they have them up there in Denver. Incidentally, I have to say, while we're on the air, how much Mary Jane and I love that area of the country.
Denver?
Yep, we had a vacation there. Once again, I don't know how long ago. But the way we took our vacation was we flew to Albuquerque, rented a car and drove up to Santa Fe and Taos. Then we drove up to Boulder. We stayed in Boulder and we stayed in Estes.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a day in Denver and we wandered. It was around this time of the year, as a matter of fact. Wandered around Rocky Mountain National Park. Just absolutely loved it.
Well, I hope you'll come back sometime. And,
I'd love to come back.
We'd love to.
I'll get on the train.
I'd love to meet you and talk to you.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
I have just a couple more questions here that I want to ask you before we self-destruct here on the radio.
Right.
Do you keep your own shows? Do you have any copies of them there?
No, I don't want
them. Do you want them, or you don't care particularly about having them, or what?
I would put them in a box and never play them, John. It makes me very uncomfortable to hear my own voice. And you may have this with your writing. I have it with mine. Everything that I have ever written, when I go back, I want to change it.
Oh, absolutely.
I can't understand why I allowed it to go out in that form. And so, I don't have anything. Somebody sent me something the other day. No, they were going to. Bud Tollison, who did sound effects, was making, on Sears at Mutual, was making copies for June Havoc of some old 16-inch acetate she had. Some radio shows she'd done. And he said, Bud called me and he said, you show up in 2 of these. Philip Mars Playhouse and a Suspense, I think it was. And he said, so I'm making you 2 cassettes. And I didn't want to say, I don't know what I'm going to do with them. It was very sweet of him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But
I don't think that's an unusual attitude. I think, you know, you talk about writing. I think Jim Bishop had a column in a couple of years ago in which he said, you know, I've written 25 or so books, and they're sitting there on the piano between 2 bookends, and he says, I never go back and look at them because I know without a question that I could do them better the second time. That's a very uncomfortable feeling.
Absolutely. And I feel the same way. Well, you know what it is with your books, so I feel that way with books, and I sure feel that way when I hear myself. I can't believe it. You know, that anybody really paid that man for talking that way seems absolutely ridiculous.
We had a question from a listener about the record album that you and Kathy put out about anniversaries.
Happy Anniversary was the first one, and Happy Holidays was the second one. We did them with Ray Noble. I wrote them and directed them. They were released by Columbia. I completely forgot about them. They were never really pushed or sent out or anything else. Never made a nickel on either one of them. And a man like you on a CBS station in St. Louis called me on the telephone one day to do an on-the-air interview, as we are doing now. And he said, of course, you're very famous in St. Louis because of the album. I thought he was talking about Manhattan Tower. And I started to say, oh, you mean Gordon? And I got about to the G in Gordon Jenkins' name, and he said, Happy Anniversary and Happy Holidays. Mm-hmm. And I said, I didn't know you could get them. He said, we have them on the station here, and we play them every year.
I've got some taped copies of them, but to answer that listener's question, if it hasn't already been, they are not available anymore. They haven't been for a while.
Just to the kind listeners, I suggest that everybody in St. Louis, if they enjoy the albums, write to CBS Records and see if they still have the master. Maybe they want to put it out again. I don't know how those
There's an idea. There's an idea. Listen, Elliot Lewis, I appreciate you coming on more than I can say. It's been a delightful hour and 10 minutes, whatever we've done here. I haven't begun to ask you all the questions that I want to ask you sometime. I hope I can get you back sometime.
Anytime, John.
To do another show. And I would also like to talk to your wife, Mary Jane Croft, who was a well-known radio actress and for many years.
Heavens, yes.
All right, we'll get back with you, and thanks again.
All right, fine, John. Thank you.
Okay, take care.